You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During its 8 years in office, the Bush administration has expanded executive power, often secretly and perhaps even unconstitutionally at times, leaving a legacy of presidential power and executive authority for the incoming administration to inherit. In an article called After the Imperial Presidency, Jonathan Mahler looked at how Congress has supported this growth in executive power and what it means for President-elect Barack Obama. It appeared in the November 9th issue of the New York Times magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Mahler back to the show. Hello.
Hi there.
Did George Bush come into office with the view that presidential power should be increased?
Well, he did, or at least one could say that his vice president did. It's pretty generally acknowledged at this point that the real architect of this sort of impulse to expand the presidency was Dick Cheney, and to an extent also his chief counsel David Addington. And in the case of Cheney, if you want to sort of dig back into his history a little bit to find the roots of it, he worked in the Ford White House. In these were the years, some sort of post-Watergate, of course, when Congress really pushed back against the executive branch. There was sort of an executive authority backlash, you might say. And so Cheney had sort of a front row seat for this sort of take back of power, or this attempted take back of power by Congress, and was, I guess, in a sense, sort of biding his time till he had a chance to sort of grab some of it back for the presidency.
Well, now we have a vice president who has been biding his time. Oh, that was a very bad pun. But it seems to me he also has expanded the power of the vice president.
That's true as well, yeah. And in fact, this to some degree dovetails with Congress's role in what's taken place over the past 8 years. Because one of the things Cheney has done is gone up sort of every week to Capitol Hill to sort of sit in on the Republican caucus, which of course is unprecedented, because Congress is supposed to meet independently of the executive branch, and in fact it's Congress's role to act as kind of a counterbalance to
but
the
he's claimed
branch.
That he's a member of the legislative branch as well as the executive branch.
Ceremonially perhaps, yes.
Now, was the move toward expanding the presidency in place even before 9/11? Because it seems to me that that's when everything really started.
It actually was. You can see sort of early indications of it pre-9/11, but of course 9/11 was what really enabled it to kind of reach a new level, and it was an opportunity in a sense. And look, historically, always in times of crisis and times of war, power tilts towards the executive branch. So that's no surprise.
How complicit was Congress in the expansion of executive power during these years? They passed the Patriot Act.
They did.
Pretty much overwhelmingly.
Overwhelmingly, with one dissension, Russ Feingold, I believe. Very complicit. And that's not something that many congressmen are perfectly willing to acknowledge. Senator Lindsey Graham, who was at times a big really defender of the Bush administration, President Bush's policies, told me point blank that the Congress were intimidated after 9/11, and we didn't insert ourselves into the debates, and I regret not having done so, and the country suffered as a result. So Congress has, certain senators certainly have acknowledged very directly that they fell down on the job.
Despite the fact that every high school history class and civics class teaches about the balance of power, the
exactly.
checks and balances.
Exactly.
The checks, they weren't aware, or they were willing to forego because it was a moment of crisis?
Yeah, it's a good question. Both. You had, you did have an administration that really operated in secret. They did things like the warrantless wiretapping program, the secret surveillance program, which no one knew anything about, or for instance, the ghost prisons, which were sort of scattered around the world, where we would send terrorists, suspected terrorists, to be interrogated coercively. Those were all secret policies. So one of Congress's jobs, of course, is oversight. And how can they do oversight when they don't know what's going on? So there was certainly. On the one hand, you can't entirely blame Congress because this administration really was operating in secret, and had an almost contemptuous attitude towards Congress. They didn't want to share information with Congress. On the other hand, There are quite a number of the policies and actions of the administration were done in plain view, and Congress at times enabled and encouraged them, as was the case with the Patriot Act, and at other times. I guess you could say look the other way and certainly didn't stop the administration.
A number of Bush administration officials have invoked executive privilege to avoid answering questions or subpoenas. And I think it was in yesterday's Times that I read that Congress is waiting to challenge that until after the Obama administration has taken office.
Right.
Because they don't feel that they could, even if they really pushed hard, that they could get much done with President Bush finally having to sign the bill?
I think that's true, that they know that they're just going to get a lot of pushback. On the other hand, I don't know. I'm not convinced that there is going to be this congressional resolve once the new administration takes office. Look, I mean, to begin with, the country's in a crisis right now, and we're in two wars, we're in this financial meltdown. So, is Congress gonna have time to pursue this? And also, the problem or the issue is that these executive privilege and state secrets privilege, these things do become very sticky legal matters. So all of this could really get tied up in the courts for years. And, is it going to be worth the fight, I guess, is the question that Congress is going to have to ask itself.
Well, for a large portion of the time that the administration has been in the White House, Republicans have controlled both houses
right.
of Congress. And people did expect, some people anyway, did expect changes after the Democrats took over. When Nancy Pelosi was here, and any number of listeners called in and wrote in asking why hasn't President Bush and why haven't President Bush and Dick Cheney been impeached? After all, their crimes, according to my listeners, were a lot worse than what Bill Clinton had done, and he was put through the whole impeachment process.
Sure.
Is it because there are so? And she said, is there just so many big issues that have to be dealt with? But my audience wasn't happy with that answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would say I wouldn't be happy with that answer necessarily either. I'm not suggesting that we push impeachment at this point. But I do think that
a little late in the game anyway.
It is indeed, yes. But on the other hand, you look at something like the warrantless wiretapping, the secret surveillance program, and that was something that was done really in direct violation of the law, the sort of explicit language of the law. It would be hard, while the administration did argue for the legality of their actions, it's a difficult argument to make. On the other hand, I mean, since the Democrats have taken Congress, I think we have seen some improvements. We've seen certainly a more aggressive approach toward oversight. There have been more hearings, more investigations. So Congress has sort of stepped up in that sense. And yet, there are plenty of examples. I think most notably the passage of the FISA bill this summer, where the president went to the Democratic Congress and asked for have his power to basically spy on American citizens increased. And Congress, even after this scandal of the warrantless wiretapping program, approved the bill, and Obama voted for it. And not only did they empower the president, they granted immunity to the telecom companies, so essentially ensuring that we're never going to really know what happened.
And when people challenged Senator Obama on that vote, he said, well, there were things in the bill he didn't like, but there were other things that he felt were necessary.
Right.
And that's
right.
Often
that is
the argument
yeah.
that people in Congress give.
Yeah. And it's a legitimate argument because, I mean, this is unfortunately, nothing. We would never get any legislation if congressmen weren't willing to make those kinds of compromises. In Obama's case, I mean, you can't ignore the fact that he was in the heat of the campaign, and
he didn't want to be called disloyal.
Didn't want to be perceived as soft on national security. So I think that was obviously an issue too. But his defense is as you say, it is a common one, and it is a legitimate one, but that doesn't necessarily get them off the hook altogether.
Do you think, and I'm going to go back to impeachment for a moment, do you think that the failure of the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton have had an opposite effect, making a president seem almost invulnerable, or also making Congress feel more reluctant to put us through another one of those terrible rituals?
I hope so. I don't know. I mean, it was such an incredibly polarizing event, and in fact, as I write about it in this piece, I mean, it's one of the reasons I think why Congress sort of fared so poorly during the Bush years is that it was left so polarized, so sort of politically polarized by the impeachment fight, that it's sort of that the various members weren't kind of hanging together. They didn't feel that they were part of the same team any longer. They now felt that their loyalty to the party was greater than their loyalty to the institution. So it really was a very sort of damaging event.
I'm talking with Jonathan Mahler, whose article After the Imperial Presidency appeared in the November 9th issue of the New York Times magazine. For that article, you spoke with Senator John Warner, a Republican of Virginia, but one of the people who seems to be less partisan sometimes than other Republicans.
Yeah.
He didn't run for re-election this year, and he talked to you about change in the culture of the Senate over the time he's been there. How different is it since he was first elected in 1979?
Very different. And I think, you know, what we spoke about and what he sort of observed was, you know, when he got to the Senate, it was almost like a family. You know, people on both sides of the aisle spent time together. They spent time over the weekends together. Their kids got together. Their kids went to the same schools. Nowadays, the Senate campaigns have become so expensive that many senators don't move their families to Washington. And most of the Senate business is now conducted between Tuesday and Thursday. So they're really in Washington only a few days a week. And to Warner's mind, this has really, really kind of eroded the fabric of the institution and has had a really, real sort of material effect on the work of the Senate.
Of course, he's from Virginia. He just takes a short...
Easy for him to say, right?
Right?
He can ride in on his
horse. What
would
happen if he was from Montana?
Exactly.
What did he tell you about his experience with the Bush White House?
Well, he told me, and actually much of this material in the article comes from another source who was close to Warner, because he's sort of a courtly and polite man who doesn't like to get into these sort of gritty details. But he was in an unusual situation because he's someone who has always been a very powerful defender of the independence of the Senate. And
he came in the post-Watergate.
He did. And he's always been very independent-minded. He's someone who has often gone against the party when he disagreed with. He refused, for instance, most famously, to support Oliver North when he was running for office, and that was considered, you know, apostasy because Oliver North was a big sort of conservative hero. So
he investigated the Abu Ghraib.
Yes, well, so exactly, and so he felt Warner after Abu Ghraib felt that really, you know, this was an enormous scandal. It was critical. This now was the moment for Congress to act and to really do a vigorous investigation to hold people responsible, et cetera. And he got a lot of pushback from the sort of right wing and end of the Senate and end of the Armed Services Committee in particular. And so he was sort of torn between his party and his duty to really kind of aggressively investigate what happened. And that, I think, is a sort of, you know, kind of emblematic of what happened in a number of occasions with more independent-minded senators who wanted to really kind of take a closer look at what the Bush administration was doing, but at the same time felt this tug from the party not to do so.
Well, he's getting on in years, but do you think that his experience over the last 8 years or so was a factor in his decision not to run again?
I don't know. I think that he certainly is not sort of pleased with how the Senate is operating these days. I mean, he's certainly that was very clear that he's a little depressed about the state of things. But I'm not sure. I mean, that's a question I guess we would have to ask him.
My guest is Jonathan Mahler. His article, After the Imperial Presidency, appeared in the November 9th issue of the New York Times magazine. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jonathan Mahler, M-A-H-L-E-R, the same spelling as the great composer. His article after the imperial presidency appeared in the New York Times magazine on Sunday, last Sunday. We are now up to something that you have written a book about. When you were here last, you talked about the challenge about the case Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. In fact, we even have a link to that on our show page at WNYC.org. But that grows out of a prime example of the growth of executive power during the Bush presidency, the way that the detainees at Guantanamo Bay have been treated.
That's right. That's right. This was a very, one of the clearest examples of this, power grab, I guess you could say, was in the aftermath of 9/11 in November 13th, almost exactly 7 years ago, 2001, President Bush issued a military order authorizing the creation of military tribunals in which we would try certain enemy combatants in the war on terror. Now, he did this in this military order. He said that he authorized the Pentagon to actually write the rules for the procedures of these trials, and he said that the federal courts could not review any of the decisions made by these tribunals. And he did this all unilaterally without any congressional input, without any congressional authorization. And that was and that's certainly sort of a very clear example of this kind of unilateral authority that he claimed. And of course, the two main characters in my book, a Navy JAG lawyer and a Georgetown law professor, challenged these tribunals at the Supreme Court on behalf of a Guantanamo detainee.
And this Supreme Court has been very sympathetic to the Bush administration, but even there, they pushed back?
They did. I mean, in fact, the Hamdan decision was really sort of a powerful rebuke of the Bush administration. It sort of held that these military tribunals were illegal to begin with, that if the president wanted to convene military tribunals, he needed to do so with Congress, which is charged with making the laws in this country. But it also went a step further. This decision said that that the president is bound by the laws and treaties of the United States, even during a time of war. Now, that may sound somewhat self-evident, but actually many of the policies inside the Bush administration, the war on terror, were built on the belief, on the argument, the legal argument, that during a time of war, the president's commander-in-chief power gave him the authority to violate these laws and treaties if he felt necessary for national security. So the Supreme Court did push back, and actually just to tie this back into this question of Congress, this was one of, as it turned out, four major decisions at the Supreme Court in the war on terror that went against the Bush administration. And, you know, the very fact that the Supreme Court had to step in and tell the Bush administration that it was overstepping its authority on four occasions says a lot, I think, about Congress's failure to get involved in these debates, that basically Congress kind of, pushed this mess over to the Supreme Court and let them deal with it.
And what has happened? Has the Bush administration pretty much abided by the Supreme Court decision?
Well, in the case of Hamdan, the Supreme Court, the Bush administration did turn around and go to Congress and ask Congress to authorize the military tribunals that it had wanted to conduct. And then there was some pushback inside Congress, and actually it was led by Senator McCain. And then there was a sort of a back and forth between McCain, Warner, and Graham, in fact, but primarily McCain, and the Bush administration. And they went back and forth over the course of the summer of 2006, and ultimately came to a compromise on a piece of legislation known as the Military Commissions Act, which allowed these military tribunals to go forward. Now, one final note is that many people still felt that these military commissions, even with this piece of legislation, were not going to provide the detainees with a fair trial and were, in fact, unconstitutional. So it was challenged again at the Supreme Court, and again the Bush administration was rebuffed last summer. So.
Well, there was a lot of pressure. McCain and Warner did support that bill, but
yes.
Arlen Specter was against it. Eventually, he voted for it.
He voted for it, even though he was vigorously opposed to it because it was going to suspend habeas corpus, and he felt that that was unconstitutional. And he was right, even though he did vote for the bill.
There has been backtracking in other areas along these lines. There was the torture bill, which was supported by Senator McCain, but during the campaign, he changed his mind.
That's right. That's right.
Is that because he felt that there were a lot of people out there who wouldn't vote for him unless he was for torture? Is there a big constituency beyond Kiefer Sutherland for that?
Surprisingly, I think there may be. But he, you know, I think, you know, in a sense, on the torture legislation, he got kind of outmaneuvered by the Bush administration. He pushed this bill through. And authored the bill against quite a bit of resistance. He managed to get it done, and then the Bush administration, President Bush, upon signing it into law, issued a signing statement saying that I don't actually have to follow any any of the sort of conditions here in this bill that I've just enacted. And then indeed McCain did later sort of backtrack when it came to the CIA and how the CIA could interrogate people, and he would argue that the CIA should be, because they're sort of trained professionals, they should be given a little more leeway than military interrogators. But I think that's.
I've been wondering about whether a future president, whether it's Barack Obama or somewhere down the line, would want to return to the good old days. Now that signing statements have become a major part of the president's arsenal, expanded totally during this administration. Had they ever been used in any way like this before?
They'd been used. I mean, it was the Reagan administration that first really started using them. But it was a little different, I think, then. I think the way the Reagan administration, really just Justice Department officials in the Reagan administration used them was more to kind of give the president's interpretation of a law, which is a little bit different than how the Bush administration has used them, which has in many cases been to reserve the right to violate the law.
I'm signing this bill into law, but then I reserve the right to ignore totally what it says.
Exactly.
Well, if somebody can do that, then I would assume that the next president is seeing himself in a very different situation, one where he feels totally justified to ignore a law but doesn't want to veto it.
Right.
Would do the same sort of thing.
Well, that is the danger. Yeah, I mean, if a sort of a precedent is created, I mean, there has been talk of actually Arlen Specter proposed some signing statement legislation that would kind of allow Congress to fight back when the president did this. But yeah, that's certainly an issue going forward. And Obama has. When he has spoken to this issue of executive authority, he has certainly expressed a different philosophy than President Bush. He's made it very clear that he doesn't believe the president is above the law, that the president has the authority to violate the laws and treaties of the United States.
He said that specifically?
He did. And yet, his history has shown that every time it's very easy to criticize the abuse of president power when you're not in office. And once you're in office, of course, you want to do everything you can to advance your agenda.
My guest is Jonathan Mahler, who wrote an article in the Sunday Times Magazine on the growth of the imperial presidency and has also written a book called The Challenge about the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Adding to this matter is the fact that President Obama will come into power with the Democrats in control of both houses of Congress. And wouldn't it be foolish of the Democrats to try to curtail the power of a president from their own party?
Yeah, well, that's certainly I think the thing to keep an eye on, because we saw during the Bush years that one party rule in Washington is sort of a recipe for presidential authority run wild.
Well, that's an argument that was used by John McCain to get more voters for him.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think even Democrats should hope that Congress will. Will be willing to really sort of take a close look at what the Obama administration is asking for and what the Obama administration is doing, that they will engage in vigorous oversight, and that they will that they'll use the tools at their disposal that the framers gave them to exert their influence. And I think that's for the health of the country, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you should want that.
But where has Congress put most of its resistance? Is it in the appointees to the courts by the Bush administration? Or some offices?
You're asking a very difficult question, because during the Bush years, we're not seeing a great—there aren't too many examples of congressional resistance. I would say that the Democrats...
But a number of offices have been left unfilled because the people proposed were unacceptable even to some Republicans in Congress.
Yes, but, you know, other people have been confirmed. You know, Mukasey, for instance, was confirmed even
with the help of Charles Schumer.
Yes, exactly, and even after saying during his confirmation hearings that he too agrees that the president does not need to obey the laws during a time of war.
He still hasn't told us whether waterboarding is a torture.
Exactly. So, you know, there have been plenty of instances where Congress could have made its voice heard and chose not to.
So is this a dark day in American history, or is this just part of the pendulum swing back and forth?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's I think we can hope that it's part of the pendulum swing. This has traditionally what's happened in this country, that the president has grabbed power and Congress has tried to take it back and has taken it back. However, we are in a situation now. Sort of the historical circumstances are such that, you know, it's very easy to see the Obama administration continuing to expand executive power because we're in this financial crisis. We're in two wars, and he's enormously popular, which is of course helpful. And he has a Democratic Congress.
And people are comparing this to the situation that FDR faced when he came to power, and we had the 100 days and all of that.
Exactly, and FDR was a sort of a prime example of a powerful executive. So you can look at it, I guess, either way. I mean, you know, historically, yes, the pendulum has usually swung back, but looking at the circumstances in that sort of historical moment we're in, my guess would be is that it's certainly not swinging back anytime soon.
Jonathan Mahler's article, After the Imperial Presidency, appeared in the November 9th issue of the New York Times Magazine. And the book, The Challenge, who's the publisher again?
Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
And that book deals with part of the story that he tells in this article, the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, Donald Rumsfeld. Thank you so much for being with us again today.
My pleasure.